Possible with support from these business partners: Devro TPAG in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine with your guest host, David Teal. In 1954, moviegoers were introduced to a new matinee idol. Known in Japan as Gojira, by the time he arrived in the United States, he was working under the stage name Godzilla, King of the Monsters. The byproduct of atomic testing, Godzilla rose from the Pacific Ocean to wreak havoc upon Japan again and again. Over the past 50 years, he has starred in nearly 30 feature films, the latest of which, Godzilla Final Wars, is now in production. Beginning Friday, October 1st at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign, Central Illinois viewers will have a rare opportunity to see the uncut Japanese-language version of the first Godzilla film. But for those who may associate Godzilla with rubber-suited wrestling matches, you may be surprised to find out his first appearance was a stark, somber portrayal that recalled the aftermath of the nuclear attacks at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. During the past five decades, Godzilla has served as a metaphor for atomic age horror, yet he has also been, at various times, a loving parent, a defender of Japan, and even the spiritual embodiment of the soldiers killed during the Pacific War. What does a 200-foot-tall radioactive reptile have to say to us about Japan's changing relationship with the United States and about Japan's reflections on its own history and future? For translation, we turn to Dr. Bill Tsutsui, Associate Professor of Japanese History at the University of Kansas, and author of the upcoming book, Godzilla on My Mind. Dr. Tsutsui, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to do this program. I will have to confess right up front that I have been long a Godzilla fan myself. So.
Oh, wonderful. Another one for the fraternity.
That's right, yes. I confess to being a very large geek. What specifically kindled your own interest in Godzilla?
You know, I think it's one of those things that one can't explain terribly rationally. I just always remember having Godzilla around me when I was a kid. I can't exactly remember watching my first Godzilla film, but I expect I was curled up on the shag carpeting in front of our family's big old Zenith TV set sometime in the early 1970s, watching the creature feature on a UHF station from Houston, Texas. And like a lot of people at that age, I think I was just thrilled to see this huge monster destroying cities, fighting enemies, vanquishing space aliens. Just the spectacle was wonderful. And I remember as a child watching the movies regularly, making the little plastic model kit, the Aurora model kit of Godzilla, you know, with the glowing hands and the glowing teeth, buying magazines, just surrounding myself with it. And so I can't really explain it in a terribly lucid fashion of why it should appeal. But as with so many American kids, Godzilla just stuck for me.
Sure, sure. Well, for me, of course, I was into dinosaurs, and he was just the biggest dinosaur of them all.
Exactly. So, yeah. That's the way a lot of people get into it, I think, through that love of dinosaurs, which as well as something is a little bit hard to explain. You know, kids love big things. Kids love somewhat mystical things and powerful things. Godzilla, dinosaurs, it all works.
You mentioned in the introduction to your book that, you know, you're outing yourself as a Godzilla fan, and it sounds like that it's something that you feel is likely to rouse suspicions in others. And what do you feel is the general perception of Japanese monster movies and the people who love them?
You know, when you said you were a bit of a geek, I think you captured it perfectly there. People tend to think that fans of science fiction, fans of Japanese monster movies are a little bit off. You know, there is this perception of the sort of archetypal science fiction or monster movie fan of maybe an overweight, early middle-aged man, poorly fitting sweatpants, tight T-shirt, like Star Trek II, Nanu Nanu, all of that, not quite fitting in with society.
Sometimes that's true.
I don't think it's quite true.
Sometimes it's true.
Sometimes it's true. But, you know, if you look at the demographics of the people who are Star Trek fans in our society, if you look at the kind of people who go to science fiction conventions or Godzilla conventions, which I've attended, it really is much more of a broad base. It really is a family activity in many cases, where it's not just sort of the hardcore aficionado, but instead it is women, it is younger people, it is older people. It cuts across society in many ways.
On one hand, a lot of people dismiss Japanese monster movies as being trivial or tacky. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there are some who might be considered guilty of overanalyzing the movies, and you know, which are, of course, are primarily intended as entertainment. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
Well, you know, I try to keep a lot of balance in this. The Godzilla movies are not great cinema by any standards. I would say the original film, the 1954 Gojira, is a classic film and is an important film which motion picture fans should watch and should see. But I don't think they're Citizen Kane. I don't think they're Gone with the Wind. They're not classic like that. And you can't really read terribly much into these films. You're not going to cure the common cold or cure cancer by looking at Godzilla films. You're not going to learn everything you need to know about U.S.-Japanese relations. At the same time, these films did reflect when they were made. They reflect the people who made them, the times in which they were made, and the situation the world was in. And so you can get a lot of insights into Japan, into Japan's relationship with the United States, into issues like science, technology, power, authority, gender, on down the line. So I don't think they're just trivial, but on some level they are just fun, and we shouldn't take them too seriously.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk for a few moments here about the origins of Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And what inspired the original film.
Godzilla really came from a variety of different sources. One was emulation. The film King Kong, the American classic, you know, Fay Wray screaming, the really classic monster on the loose picture, was re-released in Japan in 1953. And it was a smash hit in Japan, as it was when it was re-released in the United States at the same time. There was also a film made in the United States called The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It talks about a monster irradiated, coming out of the sea, attacking the city, finally beaten back. This, too, was released in Japan in 1953, proved very, very popular. So Japanese filmmakers of this time, who are never loath to steal a good idea from Hollywood, were thinking, giant monster sells tickets. This then merged with the politics of the time, with the headlines from the newspapers. The original Godzilla film was extremely topical, and it related in particular to nuclear fear, nuclear anxiety, and Cold War tensions. In March of 1954, the United States tested a huge nuclear weapon on Bikini Atoll in the South Pacific. A Japanese fishing boat called the Lucky Dragon No. 5 happened to stray into the testing area by mistake. The ship was exposed to fallout from the radiation. The sailors didn't know quite what it was. They didn't take it too seriously, but they all became sick with radiation illness. Subsequently, the fish they'd caught on the trip was released onto the market in Japan. Some may have been consumed, and then it was found out that it was irradiated. And this started a huge controversy in Japan. Some people called it at the time the second atomic bombing of Japan, referring back to the atomic bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that Japan had somehow been attacked again by the United States. And it really stirred anxieties among the people. They were afraid of testing. They were afraid of radiation. They were afraid of the threat of nuclear war. And the filmmakers picked up on this. And Godzilla, in fact, begins with very clear references to this Lucky Dragon incident and very clear warnings about nuclear testing.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I think it's a feature of several of the films where, you know, fishing boats would be the first thing to be attacked.
Exactly. This was a very powerful image to Japanese people at the time, because when they saw it, they thought of this incident. Whereas to American audiences, you know, to you and I when we were kids, it very likely didn't mean very much. But to Japanese, it was rooted in a time when people were very afraid. If you can imagine, most people in Japan stopped eating fish in early 1954 after this incident. you can imagine what impact this had on society.
Sure. Now, one thing that you had pointed out in your book, and it's something I hadn't really thought much about as a fan of old 50s science fiction films, a lot of films of that period involve radiation. And mm-hmm. what you had suggested in the book was that for most of these, radiation was just kind of an excuse to have a giant insect, that it would have been, in another time, it would have been something else. Was just the reason for its existence, whereas with Godzilla, I mean, he really is kind of the nuclear horror personified.
Exactly. You know, many critics have noted that in American sort of giant monster pictures, remember the big ants in Them and the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and so forth, radiation is in fact a gimmick. It just is an excuse to make something large and mean. And there really is no deeper meaning to it. There is no reflection on destruction, on nuclear holocaust, on humankind's tampering with the environment, and the costs of that. Godzilla was very, very different. And part of that difference, no doubt, was due to the fact that Japan had experienced the atomic bombings firsthand. They had suffered through this holocaust, and so their fear of what could happen was much more intense.
How else did the film and the director evoke the memories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
You know, if you look at the film, there are some wonderful scenes in there, which, again, if you're not thinking of Japan's wartime experience, might be lost on you. But scenes of people being evacuated from the cities, of children being taken off in army trucks to safety in the countryside, of people loading their households and their lifetime belonging onto carts and dragging them out to the countryside. This directly paralleled what the Japanese people had to do in World War II, not just from the atomic bombings, but from the incendiary bombings of Japan's major cities by the Allies. So it really evoked for them this strong sense of fear, escape, and danger from the war.
I think another interesting thing about Godzilla, as opposed to some of the other monsters of the time period, is just the scale. That
mm-hmm.
he's just enormous in comparison to even, say, the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
That's right. He is a huge, huge monster, and I think that is really part of his appeal. People respond to that size.
I want to take a moment here to give the phone numbers for questions. You're welcome to call in. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., even on Monster Island, use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I want to talk, too, about just the way that the film treats the issue of weapons of mass destruction. You have this character, Dr. Sarazawa, who is mm-hmm. this very kind of he's a very serious character. I mean, for a scientist, a kind of even a mad scientist within a giant monster movie, he's this very nuanced character and ultimately a tragic figure.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on with Dr. Sarazawa in the movie, and there are a lot of different ways you can read it. Not to destroy the movie for someone who hasn't seen it, but Dr. Sarazawa develops a weapon called the Oxygen Destroyer that is even more powerful than nuclear bombs. And he is torn, profoundly torn, about whether he should make this weapon public, allow it to be used against Godzilla, but then perhaps make it available for nations to use against other nations. And he really is in a horrible moral quandary about what should be done. He ultimately makes a very noble decision, a self-sacrificing decision, which I think in the film has clear political overtones. The message that the original film sends us is that American nuclear science, American technology, is used for negative ends, for bad ends. Bombs are made out of it. In the Japanese case, Japanese scientists perhaps are more noble, think more about humanity. Japanese science is good, used to kill the monster, but not used as a weapon of mass destruction.
Now, one thing, of course, that most people think about probably when they think of Godzilla films is kind of low-budget affairs. But this was originally, this was a major production for Toho Studios, right?
This was a huge investment. This cost several times more than their average feature film would have in this time. Its filming time was much longer, and the special effects were much more sophisticated than any other film they had made up to this point. It also featured some very well-known actors. This had a star-studded cast. The people who worked on it, the director, the producer, they were well-known professionals. The director, in fact, was a protege of the most famous Japanese director of the 20th century, Akira Kurosawa. He had sterling credentials. This was not intended to be humorous kiddie fare. This was made for adults. It had a serious message. And the special effects for the time were pretty darn good.
Yeah, that's one thing. And you know, granted, I'm a bit of a Godzilla apologist, but but one of the things that, you know, over the years you hear, the toy cities and toy trains and all that. And I said, you know, honestly, there's a lot of work that goes into building some of those city models. Now, there are examples of some very cheap effects in the films, especially the later ones. But
by our standards now, there are some howlers in that original film.
But still, just building these very elaborate models that are built to crumble in a certain way or blow up in a certain way, I mean, that really is a lot more work than people might think initially.
There's a tremendous amount of craftsmanship that went into this model. And into making these models. The person who was in charge of the special effects was a man named Tsuburaya. He went on to create Ultraman. It was sort of one of his greatest creations. During World War II, he worked for the Japanese government making propaganda films. And one of his most famous achievements was making a propaganda film version of the attack on Pearl Harbor. When the American Army captured this film and screened it, they believed they were watching the actual attack filmed from one of the planes. They didn't realize it was special effects work. And that just shows how good it was.
I want to take a moment to let folks who may have tuned in late know about our guest. He's Dr. Bill Tsutsui. He's the Associate Professor of Japanese History at the University of Kansas. He's author of the upcoming book, Godzilla on My Mind. You're welcome to call in with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. And anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Now, when Godzilla was brought over to the U.S., it was, you know, picked up by an American distributor, and they substantially reworked the film.
Yes, they believed that Americans would never read subtitles on a monster movie. And they were loath to dub the whole thing because they thought it was a little bit better than that. So they went to sort of a halfway house, where they heavily edited the original film and added a great deal of new footage. And the new footage featured Raymond Burr as an American reporter named Steve Martin, who was in Tokyo and who narrates the attack of Godzilla on Japan. And it really is pretty clever work. If you watch the American version, which was released in 1956 under the title Godzilla, King of the Monsters, it's a darn good film. And you might not even notice the extent to which it has been cut and pasted and chopped from the Japanese original. Nevertheless, about a third of the original film was cut out, and much of the substance of the original film, a lot of the anti-nuclear message, a lot of the pacifist message of that original film got left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, and this is a film that, I mean, has been, up until this point, has been very little seen in this country. I had a chance to see it a few years back at one of those Godzilla festivals up in Chicago. But in general, this has almost never been seen. So this, for the 50th anniversary this year, they've decided to do kind of an art house release of it, and it's finally coming to the Champaign area.
It was worth the wait, though. It's a great film and a great print of it.
Yeah, it is really, I mean, just surprising to watch that. I mean, it is just so very different from what came later on. And, I mean, we'll address that in a moment. But we've got a caller here. This is Line 4 cell phone from DeWitt County. Line 4.
Yeah, I'll state my question quick. I got to drive a combine here. But I'm a big fan of these Godzilla things, but there's so much about Japanese culture in them that seems just totally unfathomable. I wonder if you could explain, if you can, in one of those, and they all run together, it's hard to pick one title from another, but in one of them there's, what, a pair of little tiny women who sing and control a monster, and could you explain what's going on there? I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
That's a great question, one that get asked a lot. I get asked a lot. The caller is asking about the two little fairies, the two little shobijin, as they're called in Japanese, the little beauties, who are South Sea Islanders princesses who control the monster Mothra, who is, of course, a giant moth. Mothra is a very interesting character to begin with. Mothra is a good monster. Mothra is sort of a chick's monster. Mothra is a she. Mothra is looks out for people. She's sympathetic to human beings. She's sympathetic to the environment. She tries to defend, usually more so than attack. Two little sort of, I don't know, 6-inch women have a psychic relationship with her, with the monster, and can communicate with the monster and to some extent control the monster. People often ask me if these little women were somehow rooted in Japanese folklore or mythology. And darn it, even asking some of the best folklorists in the field, nobody can find anything in Japanese culture that explains why they were there.
Is there anything in Japanese culture about a giant moth?
There's nothing about a giant moth either.
Because, one thing I always thought is, somebody who doesn't know much about Japanese culture outside of things like this, I always thought it just seemed so very Japanese in a way to make a monster out of a moth, out of something so ephemeral that normally, would never be any kind of a threat. Generally, if you're going to go for a giant bug, it's going to be, a spider or something really, that is aggressive, and yet, a moth. And
I would even think a butterfly might work better, but they chose a moth for reasons unknown, and there isn't, as in this country, there isn't a whole lot of moth culture in Japan, so it's a little bit hard to know. A lot of these monsters were thought up by producers or by creative teams at the studios on very short notice. It actually must have been a tremendously fun job to design these things, because many of these monsters are just outrageous. They're ludicrous creations. But Mothra has been incredibly popular over the years. People really identify with this monster because it is good-hearted. And in the original film featuring Mothra, which was made in 1961, Mothra is depicted very clearly with Christian imagery, which is very strange indeed. But it goes with this image of a very generous, good creature.
Well, she originally sacrifices herself, or at least indeed. I think in one of the later ones.
Indeed. That is part of the character of Mothra, too, to sacrifice herself for the good of her people or humanity in general.
And then be reborn as the larvae or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of endless cycle of Mothras. We have another call on line four. No, we don't. Well, let's see. We will go to another question then. The program changed over, the character changed over the years. Of course, when we talked about, initially it was kind of atomic destruction personified.
Mm-hmm.
But then over the years, Godzilla becomes the defender of Japan and then back again. So
right.
What accounts for these personality shifts?
This really, I think, as much as anything, reflects how the Japanese look at themselves and how they view their place in the world. In the 1950s, the Japanese felt extremely vulnerable. Of course, defeat had come in 1945. The country was still very poor. It was rebuilding, but the rebuilding process took quite a long time. Japan was essentially powerless in the world. It was caught between the two superpowers, between the U.S. and Russia. There was China in the backyard. So Japan really felt like it was in the crosshairs of the world. And this kind of vulnerability, this kind of anxiety is clearly reflected in the first Godzilla movie, really in the first two Godzilla movies, which are quite dark, where the monster is an enemy of Japan. The monster attacks Japan almost irrationally and really threatens the country.
We do have a caller now on line four. I believe this is Ludlow, Massachusetts.
Wow. Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Got a question for Dr. Suzui. How are the Godzilla movies treated in Japan? Because I know how they're not respected here, but how are they respected there? And do you think there'll ever be a day when we'll see them in their uncut form here in the United States?
That's another really great question. I think Japanese viewers do tend to see the Godzilla films a little bit differently than we do in the United States. And one reason is because of the cutting and the dubbing and the translation that takes place as they come across the Pacific. Japanese viewers can see the films in an unadulterated form, and they're also able to get some of the more serious messages that the filmmakers have put into the films that we in the United States miss because of that linguistic intermediation. So in Japan, the films tend to be taken a little bit more seriously. That being said, the Godzilla film's prime audience in Japan, as in the United States, tends to be either hardcore Godzilla fans or else kids. And so to a certain extent, there isn't all that much difference in how the films are seen. Most Japanese, like most Americans, might tend to give a bit of a chuckle when they think about a Godzilla film, unless they're a real fan. I would love to see the day where we could get uncut versions of the Japanese films with quality subtitles in this country. And I know a lot of fans would like to see that as well. I'm not really holding my breath, however.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your answer. Thanks.
Thank you. And yeah, that's something I've noticed that that Toho Studios and then Sony, who owns the U.S. rights to Godzilla, they hasn't been very good about getting the films out, even on DVD, even a lot of the older films.
It's been very, very slow. It's been very disappointing, I think, for a lot of fans who are used to seeing sort of third-rate copies or bootleg copies. For many years, the only way in this country you could see the original 1954 Godzilla was on a bootleg VHS, you know, maybe siphoned through Hong Kong or Taiwan or something like that. So it would be wonderful if we could have sort of a collector's edition of the Godzilla originals.
One film that always interested me, and I know you don't seem very fond of it in the book, but one that I like is what was released over here is Godzilla versus the Smog Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is just because of when I grew up, this was always on at the drive-in, so I saw it a lot more than probably most of the other films. But this was a movie that was made in 1971. Godzilla takes on essentially a big walking hunk of pollution. And what I find interesting is, you know, by this time, of course, now Godzilla is an unambiguous hero. He's not even an anti-hero. He's just a flat out, Godzilla is going to come in and save the world from pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, am I reading too much into it? Is this maybe a change in the perception of nuclear power, that nuclear power was somehow going to save Japan from the threat of pollution, which was very great at the time?
That's a very interesting reading and one that I haven't thought of, but I think it might be on target. Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster is a fascinating film. For many people, it's one of the best films. For a lot of people, it is by far the worst film. I think it's one you got to see because it is very different from the other ones. It has a serious message. This anti-pollution, pro-environment message is probably the most serious message in a Godzilla film since the 1954 original with its anti-nuclear message. And The Smog Monster, I think, is 1971. In between, most of them were not that substantive. The producer and the director who made it, had read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. He was familiar with the environmental movement in the United States, and he wanted to make a serious message. He also wanted to make a somewhat experimental film. For those of you who haven't seen it, Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster is crazy sometimes. It has psychedelic moments. It has these weird montage shots with people talking all over the screen, and it has some animation in it that's really redolent of Monty Python. It is not your average Godzilla movie by any means.
Well, and it's one, too, that focuses a little more on the cost in human life, which typically gets left out of these films.
Indeed. You know, that is something that the first film had, where you get to see the human impact of the monster's destruction. That really brings home the nuclear impact, the horror of nuclear testing and radiation. Then it is lost, and the films have become increasingly aimed towards children, aimed towards a broader audience. A lot of that violence, a lot of that human suffering is glossed over. But then in The Smog Monster, there are quite horrific scenes that really do bring home this notion that pollution is killing us.
We want to reintroduce our guest. This is Dr. Bill Tsutsui, Associate Professor of Japanese History at the University of Kansas, author of the book Godzilla on My Mind. You can give us a call at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One aspect I think is interesting about these films is the role of the Japanese Army. And you use the phrase military pornography to describe the kind of parade of Japanese weaponry.
you know, in the wake of World War II, it was impossible to make typical war films in Japan. You couldn't make a gung-ho war film that showed the military in action. It was politically impossible to do that because, of course, Japan had been the imperial power in Asia. Japan had attacked the United States. So movie makers couldn't really celebrate Japan's military exploits. And that cuts a huge amount of material out of studios' potential subjects for filmmaking. People have enjoyed watching war films for a long time, but really Japanese studios couldn't make them in the 1950s and 1960s.
One thing that I think is interesting about this, too, is that the Japanese military in the movies is not only, you know, powerful, but has access to all sorts of super weaponry.
Exactly.
Laser cannons, giant robots, flying saucers, and whatever. And yet, you know, so on one hand, you've got this, you know, Japan is the greatest military power around. But on the other hand, they're still almost completely useless.
That's right. I mean, there are very mixed messages here about authority and about the military. On the one hand, the Godzilla films allow you to see the military in action, so that they allow you to get this kind of voyeuristic spur from watching the Japanese military fighting, and they look valiant, and the howitzers are blaring, and the ray guns are shooting, and they look terribly impressive. And yet, as you say, it's right. They can't stop the monsters. They always end up losing or being impotent on the battlefield. So maybe there is a more critical subtext there that is suggesting that, you know, for all the military might bluster, it still isn't the solution to our problems.
One of the more blatant political films, I think, is one that was made in 1991. It's Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. And at the time, it was perceived as having kind of an anti-American slant. And certainly as an American viewer, I mean, it seems obvious, to me at least. But maybe that's not what was intended, but it does seem to be to have that kind of slant. And it also, but on the other hand, seems to express some sort of ambivalence about Japan's economic prosperity during that time. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the plot of that and maybe what I'm seeing in it, at least.
Yeah, 1991, of course, was a time when Japan was riding on top of the world. Many people in Japan thought Japan was going to be the only superpower in the 21st century, that Japan had vanquished America forever economically. And the film reflects this kind of arrogance about Japan. The thing about the film that really inflamed American tensions is Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah posited a new genesis story for Godzilla. It essentially said Godzilla was a dinosaur that somehow had managed to survive on a South Pacific island. During World War II, then, that island was occupied by the Japanese Marines. When the Americans came to attack the Japanese Marines, Godzilla came out of the jungles and actually fought on the Japanese side. He joined up with the Japanese Marines, and there's some either horrific or hilarious scenes, depending on how you look at it in the film, where this big dinosaur foot comes and stomps American soldiers on the beaches of this island. The monster then is wounded in the battle. The Japanese Marines leave the island, assuming the monster or assuming the dinosaur will die. Subsequently, then, that island is used by the Americans for nuclear testing in the 1950s. The dinosaur is irradiated, becomes the monster Godzilla. But then rather than going and attacking America, which one might think logically would be the course of events, the monster comes and attacks Japan. And this is where maybe some of that ambivalence you were talking about comes into things, because Godzilla becomes, in a way, a conscience for Japan. Japan seems to be riding on top of the world. Japan seems to be invincible, and yet there's always the monster out there. There's always Godzilla who can come, stomp on Tokyo, destroy the glamorous skyscrapers, destroy all those economic achievements in just the drop of a hat.
Well, there's a character in there, too, who is a soldier, a Japanese soldier during World War II, who is a businessman in the present day. And Godzilla seems to just pick him out of everybody to attack. And so, I mean, at first, he rescues him during World War II from the Americans, and then later on goes way out of his way to blast him. And so I wondered, what was that saying? That seemed very strange to me.
It's, it's, it's a great scene, you know, where Godzilla walks through Tokyo, destroying everything in his path, and finally finds this businessman in the penthouse of his 75-story building in downtown Tokyo, looks in at him through the window, and their eyes meet. Godzilla looks at this Japanese businessman, and for a moment they each cock their heads. There's a kind of recognition that they'd seen each other 45 years earlier. And then Godzilla puts his head back as if in a reverie, but instead of, you know, maybe saying a sweet nothing to him, instead lets loose with his radioactive breath and blasts the man into oblivion. I think there's a real statement here that somehow something had gone wrong with the businessman in the years after World War II. He had not followed a path of justice. He was not upright and principled. He'd been sort of a dirty businessman. He'd done a lot of bad things, and this was Godzilla taking out revenge for that, sort of bringing justice to the situation.
Well, and there's one of the recent films, Godzilla is kind of recast as being the spiritual personification of the Japanese war dead. And I wondered if you could talk to that a moment.
This is something that a lot of American viewers have a really hard time understanding. If you go into chat rooms of Godzilla fans, a lot of time they can't understand why it makes sense that Godzilla is this kind of personification of all of the Japanese war dead from World War II coming back to Japan. I think the thinking here by many Japanese, and this is especially a popular line amongst conservative Japanese commentators, is that Japan as a nation has not recognized the sacrifice of the people who died in World War II, especially the people who died on far-flung battlefields in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. That Japan has gone on to build up a great economic empire, become a very rich country, but it has done so by turning its back on that older generation, sort of the greatest generation in Japan, who really made the ultimate sacrifice to help Japan in what they thought was a noble cause. And so people have read, and I think even some of the makers of the Godzilla movies have suggested that they were thinking this too, that somehow Godzilla's vengeance upon Japan can be explained in terms of these souls the Japanese victims of World War II coming back and demanding attention from contemporary Japanese.
We have a caller from Missouri. Missouri, you're on the air.
Hi, I had a question for the doctor concerning the movie The Mysterians. I had read an article online that made me look at that film in a completely different way. The writer was comparing that movie with the U.S. military occupation of Japan during the late 1940s and through the 50s. And I was going to see if the doctor had seen any comparisons with that or what his opinion was.
A great question. I have not seen The Mysterians in years. That was one of the other science fiction films made by Toho Studios about the same time that the Godzilla films were being made, and is really highly thought of as a work of science fiction coming out of Japanese movie-making industry. I haven't seen that comparison to the occupation, but from what I remember of the film, I think it could work. Certainly this was something in people's minds at the time. There was a lot of baggage left over from the war, from the occupation period, and then the new fears of the Cold War, and those were played out in science fiction movies commonly.
Thank you very much for your call. In 1998, Godzilla was remade, sort of, by Sony TriStar as a big-budget American kind of would-be blockbuster. But the film wasn't well-received either by critics or by Godzilla fans. And what do you think went wrong with that?
You know, on one level, the TriStar Godzilla is a fine film. The special effects in particular are just stunning in that film. I mean, now we've become even a little bit more jaded. But for the time, that was just a real state-of-the-art picture. The problem was, of course, it wasn't Godzilla. It was sort of Jurassic Park on steroids rather than the monster from Japan that those of us fans know and love. And so it just didn't seem right. Really what the movie was about was a female velociraptor running through New York after laying her eggs in Madison Square Garden. It wasn't this metaphorical monster deep in meaning that had come from Japan being remade for the American screen. It was really a completely different product. So if you put it in the context of the Godzilla films, it really just doesn't fit. It's not like any of the others, and most fans of the Godzilla films didn't like it very much. But if you look at it just as an action film, a special effects sort of extravaganza, it was okay.
Yeah, and they blamed it on the French, too.
That's right. That was one of the real cop-outs of that film, I think, that the nuclear testing was French. One of the interesting things is there was a recent review of the 1954 Godzilla re-release in a major magazine where the reviewer completely misunderstood that it was American nuclear testing that caused the monster, and they believed it was Japanese nuclear testing.
I did want to just quickly point out that my understanding is that the Japanese Godzilla fights the American Godzilla in the movie that's coming out later this year.
I have heard that as well. I don't know.
There's been a clip online that shows him getting swatted with a tail. And I just find that very amusing. We've got about just a few minutes left here. We've got a caller from Allerton on line two. Line two, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. One thing you fellas haven't touched on about the appeal of these movies, at least for me, I'm sure a lot of other folks, is the campy dialogue and the American redubbing. I'm wondering what you know about that. It seems like they use the same actor, year after year. But do you know who was responsible for the writing of that redubbing dialogue?
The dubbing and translation of these movies are really somewhat mysterious. They were done about as cheaply as was possible. Many of them were done on the West Coast in California. Some of them were done in New York City on a small studio there. A few of them were even done in Hong Kong by teams of people who usually made martial arts films. There wasn't a lot of care put into the translations, and there really often wasn't that much care put into trying to match voices to characters.
Right. Comedians have made fun of that for years and years, and rightly so. But I'm wondering, what do the Japanese think about... do they think that the dialogue makes them look foolish, or as a people, or do you know anything about?
I honestly don't know how Japanese would view this. Of course, Japanese are very used to watching American movies and American TV dubbed into Japanese as well, which might be just as funny to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I guess, now, of course, we've got Godzilla Final Wars coming out. I don't know when or if it'll actually be released over here, but it's apparently a big production, and they've been promoting it as kind of a swan song for Godzilla. And I wonder, do you feel this is really the end, or will Godzilla continue on?
Oh, Godzilla's died so many times, it's easy to lose count. Godzilla's never going to die. First of all, he's never going to die because he has so many fans around the world. The other reason he's never going to die is because he's a really valuable property. You can still sell things with Godzilla. And I believe Godzilla may be a little bit tired in Japan right now. The box offices have been going down the past few years. And so I think the studio sees this as a way of making a big blockbuster that hopefully will make a lot of money, then put the movies on hiatus for 2, 3, maybe even 5 years, and then bring him back with an even bigger bang to maximize that franchise.
They're certainly appealing to the geek in me. I mean, they're promising, I think, a kind of destroy all monsters for the new millennium, big parade of monsters and such. And so it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Sounds like it's going to be terrific.
Very much looking forward to that. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. But our guest on the Afternoon Magazine during this hour was Dr. Bill Tsutsui, Associate Professor of Japanese History at the University of Kansas, author of the upcoming book Godzilla on My Mind. It will be available in paperback in mid-October from Palgrave Macmillan. In addition, you can see how it all began when the original Japanese language version of Godzilla comes this Friday, October 1st, to the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. Thank you, Dr. Tsutsui, for being our guest.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks. And now, in the interest of fairness, we'll give the final word to Godzilla. Executive producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. You're listening to WILL AM, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Next up is Todd Gleason with the settlement prices from the Board of Trade.
Hi, David. Well, I think Godzilla must have been a little long in the wheat pit for the afternoon as the prices there went down, and he must have been upset for the day. Interesting program, by the way. Let's take a look at what happened at the Board of Trade today. December corn futures, or rather December wheat futures, 323.5, the high, the low at 315.5. Settlement price there at 315.75, down 4.75 for the day. The March contract at 335, the high, the low at 327.25. Settlement price at 327.75, and they were down 5 cents too. May futures, 340 the high, the low at 332, settled 333, down 5.5 cents. And July futures at 343.5 high, low at 336.5, settled 336.75, down 4.5 of the day. September contract at the Board of Trade in the wheat pit, 348 the high, the low at 343, settled on that low. They were down 4 cents for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, 209.75, the high, the low at 206.5, settlement price at 208.5. They were off 3/4. March corn, 220.25, the high, the low at 217.25. Settlement price at 219.5, a penny and a quarter higher for the day. May futures at 227.25, high, low at 224.5, a settlement price at 226.25, off one, or rather up one. And July futures, 233.25, the high, the low at 231. Settled 232.5, they were 1.25 higher. September contract at 239.25 high, low at 237.25, settlement price at 238.75, a penny and 3/4 higher. And December for next year, up a penny and 3/4, 246 the high, the low at 244.5, and a settlement price at 246. Let's go back and catch that December nearby contract. I believe I said it was down 3/4. Actually, it was up 3/4 for the day. Now December oats, 155.5 the high. Low at 146, settlement price at 146.25, down 10.75 for the day. March contract, 160 the high, the low at 153, settled 153, they were off 9.5 cents. From the soy complex, the nearby November's 534 the high, the low at 528.5, settlement price at 531.5, a half higher. January futures, 541.5 the high, low at 536.5, settled there at 539.5, up a quarter for the day. March futures, 548.5 high, low at 543.5, a settlement price at 546.75, a quarter higher, and the May beans unchanged today. 556 the high, the low at 552, settlement price at 553.5. July futures, 563 the high, the low at 558.5, settled at 560.5, a quarter higher, and the August soybeans, 560 the high, the low, and the settlement price all at 560. In the August for next year, down a penny. Bean meal futures, 158.90, the high, the low at 157.80, settled 158.20, they were off 30. December mean bean meal up 40, 162 the high, the low at 160.80, settled 161.60. October bean oil now, 21.13, the high, the low at 20.82, settled 20.85, they were down 26. And December bean oil, 21.08, the high, the low at 20.76, settlement price at 20.83, down 16. During the closing market report this afternoon, of course, we'll talk with our regular Tuesday analyst, Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, and we'll hear all about crop progress across the three I states, Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa. Some interesting numbers nationally to take a look at. In Illinois, 27% of the corn crop has been harvested, but Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota are way behind. In fact, in Minnesota, farmers haven't harvested beans or corn at this point. They came in at a big zero yesterday afternoon. Those crop progress reports we'll take a look at during the closing market report. Be sure to stay tuned for that at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Standard Time today. Now in with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, I believe, is Jay Pierce.
That would be Tom Rogers.
Oh, it's actually Tom Rogers. I only saw you out of the corner of my eye walk through, Tom.
I look like Jay.
Well as you go around the corner.
I'll take it as a compliment.
All right.
Here are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Starting with feeder cattle, where we had a mixed day today. September feeders had a high of 115 even, a low of 114.80, settlement at 114.87.5. That was down 7.5 on the day. October had a high of 111.60, the low 110.50, settled at 111.20. That was up 55 cents. And the November feeder cattle contract, high today of 109.95, the low 108.85, settled at 109.47.5, up 37.5 points. So the live cattle market, October had a high today of 84.40, the low 83.52.5, the settlement at 84.10. That was up 30 on the day. December live cattle had a high of 87.17.5, the low 86.25, settled at 86.65, up 22.5. To the hogs now, a down day all around. Lean hogs for October had a high of 75.70, a low of 73.60, settled at 74.20, down 135. December had a high of 69.15, a low of 67.15, settlement at 67.82.5, down 1 even. The February lean hog contract had a high of 66.10, a low of 64.85, settled at 65.30, down 55. And April lean hogs had a high today of 63.80 and a low of 62.70. It settled at 63.25. That was down 67.5 points. And the February frozen pork belly contract, the high today 97.50, the low 94.72.5. The settlement today, 94.95, and that was down 255. Looking at the outside markets right now, we see the Dow is up 74 points at 10,062. The NASDAQ up about 5 points at 1,865. The S&P up 6 points at 1,110. Those are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange and Wall Street.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jenny Feldman from Cross Village, Michigan writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do some of the ice cubes pop right out while other ones stick to the side of the tray? Mom said you would know."
Making generalizations about ice cubes is just as insulting to the ice cube and reflects just as poorly on your level of enlightenment as making generalizations about different races or cultures. An old ice cube adage goes, 16 cubes in a tray, 16 different rhomboids. Another goes, no angle is really 90 degrees, especially when you deal with water. No one ever said ice cubes were poetic. But they do have a tolerance for diversity that you apparently lack. Maybe if you could see things from an ice cube's angle, it'd help you escape from the narrow prison of your own mind. Find a walk-in freezer and spend a few minutes with the door shut, imagining life in an indented blue plastic tray.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
To order the Dr. Science Smug Mug 6-Pack, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
David Teal will be back on the Afternoon Magazine in about 45 minutes, and he'll be talking with writer Danny Gregory, the author of Change Your Underwear Twice a Week, Lessons from the Golden Age of Classroom Film Strip. If you're anywhere over the age of 30, you'll probably understand and enjoy, certainly, all of the stuff that we'll be talking about from the era of